you'll just feel that. You'll just know that. Those are the machines where when you're doing, as you were on that pec deck machine, as you're grinding out reps, you don't have a sticking point.
Hey, what's going on, guys? On this episode of Muscle Minds, Dr. Scott has prepared a lecture for us on picking the perfect exercise, how and why an exercise works or doesn't work for you. And after that, we've got a bunch of listener questions. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally. I'm here with Dr. Scott Stevenson. All of our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com and GetAzoff.com. We got links for that stuff down in the descriptions. Dr. Scott, we are going to discuss what exercises work for you. And as Vincent Ford just said, he says, what does it say here? He says, I'm ready for Dr. Scott to melt my brain. Let's do some brain melting.
Okay, so it's an interesting thing. Like you sent me something about upright rows, which is one exercise that people do a whole bunch of different ways. And there's a reason for that. Could be various reasons for that. And I get questions from people who've been training for a decade, 20 years about like new exercises. They haven't figured out what exercises work for them. So I have a presentation I've given a few times on, it's called Quest for the Perfect Rep, which you liked. And that's about basically kind of breaking down how and why an exercise would work for you. Is there one perfect exercise? As another aside, for instance, on my Instagram channel, I've got all these sort of alternate exercises, things I've kind of whipped up, which is what Dante, speaking of DC training and Dante, he would call getting funky with it. Okay. Which is sometimes what you have to do. If you to find a way to stimulate a muscle in a novel way that will produce growth because it's not growing or you've just gotten so big, you need to come up with different ways to train.
Yeah.
So there is a ton to this. When you're picking an exercise, first of all, safety, you don't hurt yourself. You need to live to train another day.
Sure.
So a big piece of that is whether you're going to go to failure or not, depending on how you set up your training. Do you train to failure? Are you a high volume guy? You leave several reps in the tank and try to sort of make up for that with volume, so to speak. So that's going to be important. You don't want to be training to failure with a barbell and having to constantly pick the weight back up if you don't have a spotter. So that's just kind of basic stuff. The biggest thing, obviously, in large part, is that you're training the target muscle. So that's the mind-muscle connection, which can be had. So how would someone know if they got a good mind-muscle connection? Some people cannot feel that during the exercise. They just can't tell. I've got a whole talk that I give on this. There are a couple things that come from that talk, because this has been demonstrated in, and I've talked about this on the podcast, in several different research studies now, looking at people's ability to not use their traps when they're doing kind of a side lateral movement. People can turn off, deactivate muscles. You can ask people to do bench presses and use more pecs or use more triceps. A couple studies have demonstrated that can be done. You can ask people to move weights rapidly or more slowly. And important things that come from that is once you get to too heavy of a load, above like 80% of one rep max, people are no longer able to turn off the muscles they don't want to train and selectively turn on the ones that are supposed to be the target muscles. So if an exercise is going to work for you, in large part, and it's one that you don't feel an innate good mind-muscle connection with, it's just not like the pec deck that you've been. That's obviously it's an isolation exercise. It's going to train the pecs.
Right.
But maybe for some people on a certain pec deck, the way they're doing it, it might have been an anterior delt machine.
Sure, I could see that
exercise for them. Yeah. So in that case, you were doing like sets of seven.
Yeah.
That's probably. For someone who doesn't have a good machine or doesn't have a good strong ability to contract the pecs preferentially, that might be too heavy for them.
I can imagine it would have been too much for me not long ago, really.
But you got a better mind-muscle connection. So here's the conundrum, if you're going to use like percentage or one rep max or what have you, is we're one rep max for a bench press, if you just – it's your true max, is going to be heavier – than your one rep max when bench pressing to train the chest.
Absolutely. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yes. So your rep performances are going to go down when you're doing a bench press or a barbell press to train the chest versus the triceps or versus just the exercise. This is the difference between powerlifting and bodybuilding, essentially. Powerlifting, you want to use as much muscle mass as you possibly can. Bodybuilding, you want to target the particular muscles that you're trying to train in those exercises, which could be using literally as little muscle mass in a certain sense, or the accessory muscles as little as possible, and the target muscles as much as possible. So you're trying to literally cause as much of an inequality in the loading target versus accessory muscles that are keeping the joints literally like the ball and socket joint of your shoulder together and helping you just do the actual exercise. You don't want those to be contributing substantially whatsoever, if at all possible, because you don't want those to be the fatiguing limiting factor. You don't want your set to come to an end because those muscles have fatigued before the other ones.
Yeah.
So if you go too heavy, relative to what you can do, that in of itself for most people means that they're using muscles in a way that doesn't have a good muscle connection. Just simply the case. The other thing is you did this really, really, really well on that pec deck. You were going really slow and controlled.
Yeah.
Just those are beautiful reps. That is something that the research also substantiates.
Mm.
And
yeah,
it makes sense.
Had I gone any faster, had I pushed any faster with it, I would have not only used some centrifugal force, but I know I would have been using other muscles. I had to move at that speed in order to be able to just focus on just the pec. I could have gotten more reps.
Yeah.
There's no question in my mind,
but
it wouldn't have been with the pec.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In order to move the weight faster or at maximal speed, you're going to have to use the max amount of muscle mass you have available.
Yeah.
So your speed is just, it's going to have to be sub-maximal if you're using less than the all of the muscle that's available, which is the whole point of bodybuilding in a strange way. So some exercises, they just lend themselves. They're your go-to exercise. They just feel good. Some people, they train bench press and their pecs just blow up.
Right.
It's not an uncommon thing. If you look, and it's funny, you see someone who has really good chest. They sometimes will not have great arms or great
I see
delts.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
Or vice versa. Big delts, big arms, and not so much chest.
I've seen that so much. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
And that was my situation early on, was that my shoulders developed first. And guess what? I was also training. I was doing bench press with my shoulders, you know, is what it came down to.
Right. Yeah. And some of that is just the function of the training, I think. And some of it's a function of how you're wired, like from birth there on. You like literally you just start doing all of your types of pressing activities during the day with your arms. Just learn how to do that. You get wired to do that. Maybe biomechanically you're better suited for that. Your nervous system just figures that stuff out.
Yeah.
So that's a huge part of all of this. You can pre-exhaust. And we talked about this ad nauseum. I talked about this on a podcast. I've done so many. The last couple of weeks, I think I've done like 4 or 5. Talked about pre-exhausting. That will create the weak link in the pre-exhausted muscle, like doing a pec deck before you do a fly.
Yeah.
So that's one way that you can take an exercise that normally wouldn't be the best chest exercise, for instance, for you, and make it into a good chest exercise.
Yeah.
So.
And that's what I had to do. That was my, you know, quote unquote trick early on to get the pecs to connect. Yeah.
Right. So I probably should have mentioned this earlier because it's very, very important, is sometimes you sit down. This is why hammer strength machines are so loved by so many people, is that they do a pretty decent job of matching the loading curve. So the load that is presented over the course of the range of motion from start to finish versus the strength curve of your average person. So that was what Nautilus was trying to attempt. Arthur Jones Nautilus and the conch-shaped pulley wheel.
Yeah.
So the idea is that, you know, the change of the diameter of the wheel as the cable moves over it, that changes the loading that occurs as you're moving the machine, the pad or the handles or whatever it is that you're moving. So, the strength curve, so the relative strength at the beginning versus where you're strongest in terms of torque produced about a joint versus the end, that curve can be like a perfect, like inverted U. It could be like kind of a bell curve. You could be much stronger at the beginning, much stronger at the end. And that's going to be a function of so many things. It would just be kind of you don't even need to name them all. That can be a function of limb lengths, relative limb lengths, relative muscle mass, the attachment points of your tendons across your joints.
Yeah.
And you'll just simply know that. So you'll, for instance, this is why powerlifters, the obvious one is the bench. There tends to be more triceps at the lockout than at the beginning.
Sure.
For most people, that's just kind of a generalized thing. So if you're looking at a chest machine of some sort and you get to the second half or near the end of the range of motion, where if you're using your pecs preferentially, then you're going to become weaker because you're not trying to use your triceps. If you've done a great job of chest activating the pecs to make things happen,
yeah,
then you should be weaker and the machine shouldn't evoke as much tension. Because the loading curve should be different. And you'll just feel that. You'll just know that. Those are the machines where when you're doing, as you were on that pec deck machine, as you're grinding out reps, you don't have a sticking point. You don't like go until like all of a sudden you're like, you're barely getting past that sticking point. And if you didn't have that sticking point, you could have ground out maybe another two or three reps and you would have slowly just come to a halt who knows where in the range of motion, because fatigue would have been the cause of ending the rep and ending the set. But if the machine is not suited to the person who's using it, or just not to anyone, and some of them just suck for everybody,
yeah,
then there'll be a sticking point and you'll like literally push and all of a sudden you'll just stop.
Yeah.
It's like shit. So that is not a good machine because it's denying you effective reps in a certain sense. Because the limitation to getting that rep isn't because the fatigue has just sort of exponentially declined, or it's gotten to a lower level where you just can't move anywhere. It's because you've got that blip in every single rep where there's loading is so high that you just have to get over that hump. So you can almost imagine this. I haven't used this analogy before, but imagine you've got a very slow decline, a hill, and it's a wavy hill. Like this,
right?
And you know, you're going down, and eventually you could keep on going further down, which would be like your fatigue level, your maximal force production ability. But because of these little bumps that you have to get over, eventually you just kind of get stuck on a bump, and you never get to the bottom.
Okay.
The bottom was where you want to be because you've created so much fatigue that you just can't lift the load.
Yeah.
So that's an issue. And another thing that can cause this, and if you feel this in a machine, this is one thing you can put in your checkbox. A machine that has a lot of concentric, a lot of friction is going to be much harder on the concentric and easier on the eccentric, on the lowering. Because the friction is going to cause more resistance when you're lifting, and it's going to lighten the load on the way down.
Okay. Huh. Interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, but that makes I'm thinking about trying to buy home gym equipment right now. And that's an issue you run into with cheaper equipment, is the friction you feel in the concentric. And I hadn't thought about how that could definitely make a negative impact then.
Or poorly maintained equipment.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a gym that I'll probably get a membership at because it's real close to, not far from me, really close to another gym that I go to. And it was it used to be one of several gyms in a chain here in town. And then that guy eventually sort of ran himself out of business, basically. So someone else bought the gym, but yeah, they have all the same equipment of a previous gym that closed. So I'm used to all those machines and I like those machines.
Yeah.
But I go in, I get on those machines at the gym that closed, and they'd be wobbly because the screws weren't in place. So you like get on some of them and like the knee extensions, like at an angle like that,
yeah,
you know, because they haven't bothered to like, because it's everything's loose and the friction's greater. Well, I got on those same machines because I've got years of training on those machines at this other gym that's now closed.
Right.
It's probably, those were bought in the same lot. They're the exact same machines. They're the Nautilus Nitro machines. Most of them. There's a couple other ones. And I'm like, well, this machine was maintained. This machine feels awesome.
Huh.
It's like it's brand new versus 10 or 15 years old. Yeah. And it's just because they maintained it better.
Okay.
And I talked to the gym owner. He's obviously a bodybuilder, and he knows how to maintain his machines.
Huh.
So that sort of segues into the next important thing, is that with that friction, that's very, very important. We're actually stronger on the eccentrics than we are on the concentrics. And if you look across the studies, sort of in general, there's a nice meta-analysis on this. There's several studies demonstrating this, that the eccentrics, because you create more load relative to the muscle used, are the most important part of the rep, so to speak.
Okay.
Is the eccentric part of the contraction. Or if you compare concentric only versus eccentric only training, you get greater gains on average for most people with the eccentrics.
It just causes more soreness. Pay attention, guys. Pay attention to that. Because that's the thing, we've talked about this on the last show. That's the thing that I think people tend to lack in. They, you know, push the weight up, they pull the weight up, and then from there they just let it go. You know, they mm-hmm. don't focus. And that is what I found in this last year, being able to make some pretty good progress now, is focusing on the eccentric portion of the rep.
Mm-hmm. There was a guy, I can't remember, it was on my Instagram. I think when you go to like a search and he just throws up whatever videos it thinks you might like.
Yeah.
And this guy was, he was deadlifting like 855.
Okay.
And the most impressive part of the deadlift, he got it, and he got it relatively easily.
Yeah.
But then he lowered it under control.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that was – because a lot of people, when the powerlifts they deadlift, they just pull it up and they just drop it.
Let it go, yeah.
It's kind of like – it'd be like, you know, fuck this weight. I'm done with you, you know. It's yeah. Somebody just do that because it's part of the attitude you have that you need to have in order to pick that much shit up off the ground.
And the boom. But, there's the boom.
And yeah. The boom is – yeah, it's kind of a badass way. Like, you know, it's like Mike Gibbles, but Mike drop.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The deadlift drop. But it's, and interestingly enough, you're also losing out on that ability to one, load the muscle during that eccentric, and also to train the nervous system to have greater control as well with those heavy loads.
Huh.
So there's specificity of contraction type. So if you do just concentric lifting – and no eccentric, they do this with dynamometers. This is a lab-based thing. You'll get much better the concentrics and not so much with the eccentrics. But I've never seen any of those studies where they compared really slow lifting, which is what has to happen when you're pulling, like, you know, singles, doubles, and triples.
Yeah.
So if you compare, like, you know, reps like a second long rep, which is a pretty fast rep speed, you train with second long concentric reps versus someone who trains with eccentric only 1 second reps. Those are wide ends, like ones in one direction, and they're pretty rapid. But you talk about heavy weight. Now you're talking about slow reps with a near maximal load. I can imagine there's gonna be a lot more carryover by doing those eccentrics just to control that. As long as you can do it safely, control that load and lower it down. You get the loading on the muscle, which is good. And you also get some experience handling that heavy load with a heavy eccentric, which I don't think is a bad thing either, as long as you're not doing too much of that and then overtraining your nervous system or in general. So that's super important. So you don't want a friction machine because it cuts you short. Every rep's going to be less effective because you're adding more to the concept. What that does is it creates more metabolic fatigue. And then when you finally do get to the end there where the – and there's a difference, too. In the physics world, there's when two surfaces are sliding together, there's a dynamic friction. There's like a coefficient of friction you can calculate for, you know, whatever two pieces of wood or some sandpaper on a plastic surface or what have you.
Yeah.
And that coefficient will be different when the things are sliding over one another versus when the two pieces are just in contact and there's no movement.
Hmm.
That's why it's very common. Like you're trying to get something moving, like a sled in the gym or anything that's on ground. Once you get it moving, it moves more easily, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like that's just, you kind of sense that. You ask anyone, they'd say, yeah, they'd agree with that for the most part. But what happens then if you got a crappy machine with lots of friction, you've got a couple of different things happening. So you start to, as you start to fatigue, you start to move from that lowered coefficient of friction when the weight's moving to where it's starting to come to a standstill, and then the friction goes up substantially.
Yeah.
So then the weight was maybe maybe it's really 100 pounds, but it's 120 or 110 because when you're moving at a decent rate, And then when you start to get slow and you start to fatigue, then that friction skyrockets because you're starting to have basically a static type of scenario because you're going so slow. And then you're just stuck. Machine's just like, that's it. You're like, fuck, the reps, the set's over.
Yeah.
So you miss the opportunity to have those really slow grinder reps.
That makes total sense.
It's not that you fatigue so fast. It's just that the weight, literally the load that you're pressing against goes up the slower you move.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can just skyrocket. So that's one part of it. The other thing that you end up doing is you sense this. You're just trying to move the weight to some degree. That's part of lifting is getting the weight moving. So you'll start like doing more ballistics type stuff.
Oh.
A lot of times it's actually you've got the momentum as well as the fact that friction is less.
Yeah, yeah. It feels smoother. Yeah, yeah. You push harder. It feels smoother.
It does. Well, then that unloads to some degree potentially on the concentric because the weight's less and it's moving so fast and you can only produce so much force. The force you produce goes down on concentrics the faster you move.
Yeah.
So you end up doing kind of bouncy reps and you're trying to like literally just keep the weight moving. And as we said before, that's not good for a good mind muscle connection because you're trying to ballistically move the weight and you're trying to move the weight quickly, keep it out of that high friction scenario when it slows down.
Yeah.
So those, like I've tried machine, sometimes you try a machine like this, I'll give it a go and you're like, that just sucked. Like it's like, okay, I'm just stuck. What the hell? You know?
Right.
It's terrible. So that's why I've always said, like, if someone really you could demonstrate this pretty easily, come up with a line of machines. And there's some machines that are out there that come and gone. The Life Fitness had one. There's some other ones that people have brought up when we talked about this on the show. But having a magnetically driven or electromagnetically braked machine that less load on the concentric relative to the eccentric.
Huh.
And that will match the loading that you can produce during those different types of muscle shortening versus lengthening contractions.
Okay, yeah.
And that's a more effective way. So at least you're not going to do that in the gym. Machines aren't going to do that, although you could have partners do that for you. But
yeah,
at least you don't want to go the other way and make the concentric so much harder than the eccentric that you're literally flip-flopping what the muscle is capable of doing.
Hmm.
So friction and then the loading curve are two important things because you'll lose out. So I think what else? So one thing you can do to make that loading curve match the strength curve is with bands and chains.
Hmm.
So that's why people would I put bands on a lot of times just because I don't want to move as many weights plates around.
Yeah.
Because it's a pain in the ass sometimes. Like if you can use four plates and a doubled up band, it's more like six plates.
Yeah.
That's much better than having to drag the extra four plates around.
Okay.
Either side of the machine. So, but the bands, a couple different things. One, they tend to load more at the end of the range of motion. That's the way it's going to be, no matter whether you reverse band or do it traditionally, or with chains.
Sure.
So if you got chains hanging out from a bar and you go down, the chains unload, and as you come up, the chains load. The difference between those being, in large part, that the bands are not going to have nearly the momentum effect that the chains will have. So, for instance, if you are someone who, like on a squat, you tend to drop down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then those chains will literally be free falling
during
that period of time.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had bands instead of the chains, the tension in the band, there'll be some loss of tension if you move too quickly, but the band's going to maintain a more consistent tension during the lowering portion.
That makes sense, yeah. Hey, what's up, guys? I'm going to talk a little bit about our sponsors, and then we will get right back to the program. So hope you guys are doing good. Hope you're reaching your goals. Hope your gym's open. I'm reaching my goals. So, you know, a big part of this is the training. In fact, I think that's a big, big factor. And then the nutrition. And a little gear, not much. We'll say like a smidgen of gear and supplements, which, you know, that's like kind of like the final factor there. Right. And in part, I kind of put that in with food, too. And of course, I'm using supplements from our sponsor, TrueNutrition.com. You know, high quality, third party tested, meaning you get what they say that you're getting. And they're owned by a guy, one of the most honest people in our industry and smart dudes, too. Dante Trudell. So you're getting good quality supplements, you know, and on top of that, if these are things that you would buy anyway, if you get them from TrueNutrition.com and you use our code, which is advices, then you directly support our programming. Honestly, you know, at home, putting in hours a day, every day on these podcasts. And I love doing it. You know, it's a lot of fun, but obviously I got to get some sort of return, right, to continue doing this. So I appreciate you guys supporting our programming by shopping with our great sponsors, because that allows me to keep doing this. And I appreciate you guys listening too. It's a lot of fun doing these shows and sharing all this stuff with you. Our other sponsor is GetAzoth.com, and we have a code for them too. Advices10. You can go to either that website, or you can go to the Amazon link in our show notes. Basically some of the coolest nootropics that are out there on the market right now. Azoth 2.0. It's a fantastic product. I've enjoyed that for like 2 years now. And now I'm experimenting with Total Focus, which contains new supplement. It's winning all sorts of supplement awards, Zynamite. So Zynamite, as you guys probably heard me talk about, is a dopamine reuptake inhibitor, meaning it keeps more dopamine in your body. And dopamine is a book I'm checking out. It's called The Molecule of More. It's about dopamine is what makes you desire. Dopamine is what makes you want to achieve. Dopamine is what makes you want to like keep making money or keep doing whatever you're doing and be the best at it. Keeps you on task, really. Keeps you focused on the chase. And it's interesting to experiment with that. You can strategically, you know, increase your dopamine where you need it to be, when you want it to be, and kind of get like a performance enhancing edge. Like I'm performance enhancing my podcasting and my nutrition work with my clients. And then, you know, I make sure that I'm not taking it at other times, like when I want to sleep, for instance. But yeah, so I'm having a lot of fun with that. If you guys want to check out some cool nootropics, you can do so using our code at our sponsor. That's advices10 at getazoth.com. Thanks for listening to me talk about all this stuff, guys. And thank you. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for listening to our shows.
Yeah. And so that then will give you more overload on the eccentric. And that's why John Meadows has said this, bands will make you more sore, but no bands or chains, because it's the eccentric part of the contraction, which tends to be the greatest cause of muscle soreness and damage and load. So if your groove for moving the weight around is maybe a little more rapid, you can try bands and see if that helps, increases the soreness or help give you a little more loading in a way that feels good.
Yeah.
So the problem is sometimes like it's nice on like a pack squat or something like that, where you tend to be weaker out of the hole.
Right.
And you want to make it more of a quad exercise. Quads tend to dominate near the end of the range of motion. It's nice when the bands will match your strength curve. So meaning a strength curve where you're stronger at the end than at the beginning of the range of motion. If it's the other way around, you're kind of fucked, you know, because there's no way really to set up the bands or chains otherwise.
Yeah.
At least not easily. So, but those are a great option for that.
Yeah.
And the one thing I will use bands for sometimes too, depending on the range of motions, bands, ideally they keep the same tension or really close to it through a long range of motion. So if you want to have bands that will give you consistent load throughout, you get the longer bands. If at all possible, you just have to figure out where to hook them up.
Right.
So there's a hammer strength chest press in one of the gyms I go to. And it's one that I can tell because it's sort of almost set up like a pendulum, in the way it's just the whole construction of the thing. So when you push, you'll get some momentum going that will allow you to kind of carry through. It's so much easier. So I put the bands on there not to overload at the end, because the bands are actually, they're stretched all the way to the back part of the frame. So the bands are pretty stretched out. So I would say, you know, increase in band length from start to finish is maybe only 20% of the initial band length. So it's not like it's a huge change in tension from start to finish.
Right.
So I'm not trying to overload at the end of the range of motion. What I'm trying to do is have tension at the beginning, at the end, and that dampens that momentum.
Okay.
Because you know, push the weight out. Literally, with a lightweight, you could literally push the weight out and throw it in front of you.
Yeah, yeah.
People doing like those jammers. Sometimes you'll see people like when they're standing and they'll do like kind of a push press type of thing, and they'll throw the weight and catch it for an explosive type power movement for football or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put the bands on to prevent that swinging from happening.
Okay.
So I don't want that. I want continuous tension.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So, but not an overload at the end, cause I'm trying to train chest. So that's like a nuance of band configuration that you can play with as well. So the question is then, and this is the thing, like the talk when I give it, or when you're going through these things, you would think, well, there would be some sort of idealized, perfectly suited exercise that, let's say for it's a chest press, that it has an arc, because the pecs are literally, you're having rotation at the shoulder joint here. The pecs are doing this. So that's the main movement you want to see. That's why a lot of those converging chest presses feel so good. Because literally, if you think about, if you're here, let's say it's almost like a fly machine, almost nothing happens at my elbows.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a pure fly, that's why a fly is it's considered an isolation exercise. The more extension you have at the elbows, generally speaking, the more triceps activation you're going to have.
Yeah.
Which is what you don't want on a chest press. So, but you want that enough arc so it feels like a press and you're getting good chest activation, but not triceps at the end. So you go like this, you end up using your triceps. You're not having much going on at the chest.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So if you think about that, the arc of the motion, the loading curve from start to finish that matches the person, that you're not losing force because of friction on the eccentric or gaining it on the concentric. What are some of the things we talked about? It's safe, you're going to go to failure or not. Then you might think, well, I can come up like there should be like one perfect exercise for every muscle group. And there's also angles, of course, for like the chest. For instance, a decline is different than an incline, for instance, in terms of hitting the chest. But the thing is that, yes, there are various factors for optimal loading, but, and this is the thing that I've been sort of pushing, and I'm to get people to sort of at least grasp. They may not agree, but this is sort of my thought on this, is that the reason why muscle grows from the stimulus in the gym is because it's a novel stimulus. What you do in the gym, we first come in, you're a newbie, and you do something like, let's say you're just training your biceps. Well, everyone's using their biceps during the day. You're eating, you know, you're picking things up, you know, you're combing your hair, whatever. You're using your biceps.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if you're not using that muscle and all of a sudden it's come out of a cast and it grows because of that.
Right.
Which actually would be novel, but you're using them, but you're not using it in that way. It's so tremendous. And then, so you start doing dumbbell curls, and eventually if you just start, keep doing sets of 10 with the 10-pound dumbbell curls, you'll get some growth, and then you'll get nothing because there's no novelty of stimulus. So then you go to the 12 and a half, so you go to the 15s, and progressively overload in your reps and or weight. So that is going to create a novelty of stress. The underlying thing is that it's new and different, and it's continually stressful in a way that creates an adaptation. Same. So what happens the first time when you have a really good workout? You can just see because you kicked ass, or the first time you go in the gym. What's the thing you notice the next couple of days when you're moving around?
That you're feeling sore?
You're sore as shit, right?
Yeah.
That's like kind of an obvious marker that you've done something new and different.
Yeah.
It's the indicator, like, this is a novel stress. You've damaged the muscle in some way. And we know, for instance, when you give mega doses of antioxidants, or you give things like NSAIDs that inhibit that inflammatory response, cold will do it too. Compression actually will do it. Things that prevent the injury and the muscle soreness also have a negative effect on growth. So there's really good reason to believe that soreness, although you're not trying to get sore, you're not trying to get too sore, but that soreness is something that you see when there's novelty of stimulus.
Yeah.
So take someone who's been deadlifting and they're doing, just barbell deadlifts, let's say, and that's what they've been doing for months on end. They're kind of plateaued out there. And then they just go to like one of those hammer strength, like shrug deadlift machines, or they pull on a Smith machine and maybe it's a deficit deadlift, or becomes a rack dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the loading curve's different, or the range of motion is different, or both. What happens the first time you train as hard as you ever have, you're going to get sore.
Sure.
Pretty much. I mean, I've done that so many times. Like, I have no doubt that'll happen to me. You just go and you just change the exercise and you get sets and reps, everything, effort could be all the same, but you get sore. It means the changing the exercise is also novelty of stimulus.
Yeah, I went back to a gym that I was training at before the shutdown. I went there yesterday to train chest. I've been training chest at the other gym for quite a while now. And so, yeah, and I did different exercises. I used a different pec deck, and then I used it was actually Nautilus, but a hammer style machine by Nautilus for chest press. Mm-hmm. That combo, I'm definitely feeling it. There's no question today.
Right. So if the goal is to create a really good stimulus for muscle growth,
yeah,
with all those things we talked about in place, that the loading curve and the strength curve match and the concentric, eccentric, all those things are in place, that's important. But also something that's novel, as long as it has some semblance of those aspects of the stimulus, it's going to be novel, and it's thus going to be more than likely, with recovery and food in place, growth promoting.
Yeah.
So changing, you don't want to just change exercises willy-nilly, because progressive overload, I think, is going to be your meat and potatoes in some way, shape, or form. And you can do it with volume too, if that's your you know, that's the slice of the pie that you want to choose to pick from. But novelty of exercise, even if it's not the ideal exercise, even if it's maybe got a little friction, it's still novel, it's still different. It may create overload. Maybe let's say the machine is a little bit heavier at the beginning of the range of motion for a chest press. It's just that's new and novel for you.
Yeah.
It's going to create some soreness, like these new exercises that you hadn't done for a while. And you've done them for years.
Right.
Right. You've been doing them for years. You know those, whether it's the nervous system that's trying to figure those out again, you know, unless you're like James Bond. You know, and you can just pick up any handgun that you may have not fired, you know, for 15 years, and you're just shooting bullseyes immediately.
Yeah.
You're going to have a little bit of practice to get back to the skill level that you once had.
Sure.
You know, maybe something like a language that you grew up speaking, it comes right to you. But training it's a motor skill, the way training is. One of the reasons why people think you get sore is because the nervous system isn't quite sure what to do with the exercise, the novel exercise, and that's the big thing, novelty of exercise in terms of producing muscle injury and muscle soreness.
Right.
So you go back into the gym, you've been doing pec decks, you've been doing flies, you've been doing presses, you've been doing all those things, but there's something new and different about those in a way that's just new and different enough for you to get pretty sore. Noticeably sore, you see that. And so soreness is something that can be used, I think, pretty effectively, even if you're just paying attention, even the subtle differences, people that don't get very, very sore, you will probably get sore. Like John Meadows is a great example, hardly ever gets sore, but every once in a while he does. And he knows, he can probably predict that because he's done something extraordinary. Either the workout was just crazy, or he's done different exercises that he hasn't used to doing because he's at a new gym with someone else that he's not used to training with.
Yeah. Yeah. I anticipated I would be today, having gone to this other gym. And like you said, performing similar movements, same movements in some cases, but definitely it feels different. I remember going back I took a year off of training at Novi Powerhouse, which is their world headquarters. They had previously been at Farmington Hills, and I trained from the time I did my first contest through like 5 years, I trained at that gym consistently, on the same equipment consistently. I took a year off, and traveled around, went to different gyms. And when I came back, I'll tell you what though, Scott, it felt like I was home. Does that make sense? Like, cause I had spent so many years learning on that equipment. I just remember getting on that pull down and just feeling like, oh yeah, this is the way a pull down's supposed to feel in my brain, you know?
Right. Yeah. That is, I know it's like going home. Like literally you've been on the road for a while and you go back to like your bedroom and your house.
Yes.
You've been in hotels or whatever. And you're like, this just feels really nice.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah.
So familiar.
Yes.
It makes you all warm and fuzzy.
It's funny because you think about it. It's like, I have a pull down here. I'm using a pull down at this gym, using a pull down at that gym, but it's all the same concept, but They're different machines.
Yeah. So the thing about this is, like, if you can look at, you could become an exercise snob.
Yeah,
and say, well,
that
machine's got friction. I'm going to use that machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but here's the thing. Let's say friction is a little bit more of a sticky example, pardon the pun. But let's say you got a machine that has like a loading curve that doesn't quite match your strength curve.
Yeah.
If you start training with that, first of all, it's going to be novel. And then if you start progressing with that, then you get progressive overload. So you still got the components that you, the big components you need for driving the training stimulus towards adaptation.
Yeah.
And the thing is then, let's say that you develop, so you will develop angle specific strength as well. That's a neurological phenomenon that more than likely, I mean, there's possibly some of it's in the muscle, but it's mainly a nervous system phenomenon where you learn how to contract more forcefully. You learn how you adapt to some degree to be able to push through that sticking point.
Yeah.
You don't want that to come as a function of just simply, you know, pulling in the accessory muscles and not the target muscle. All that will be there to some degree, but then you go back to another machine and that will be in play to some degree. There'll be some carryover where now you're stronger near the last third of the range of motion
mm-hmm.
that you wouldn't have been had you not trained in that way. This is why, for instance, people will do deficit deadlifts if they have a problem pulling off the floor.
Mm-hmm.
If that's where they get stuck, they just can't. Once they get the weight moving off the floor, then the deadlift will come up. A good way to train past that sticking point is start doing deficit deadlifts because you're basically putting even more emphasis on the part of the range of motion where you're weak.
Yeah.
And then once you get good at those, when you come back up to pulling off the floor, it's relatively easier.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what does that mean then? Let's say we're using deadlifts in this example as like an overall body stimulus for muscle growth. And someone trained with long ago, it had a training partner that called them, I'm not going to take credit for this, but he called deadlifts DNA changers. And some people don't like them, but I fucking love that term.
Yeah.
Because it is. Like, you take someone who hasn't been deadlifting,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, regardless of whether they make it a full body or a leg exercise or a back exercise, and then you just have them start deadlifting, and they go from, like, let's say rack deads, mid-shin, 400 to 600 pounds.
Right.
You're going to see them. They're going to look like Bruce Banner initially, and then like the Hulk from the back. Like, it's like you're going to see that.
Yeah, yeah.
Tremendously so. So that person, let's say now they're doing rack deads, and that's where they would fail, is that getting the weight up and moving. So they start doing full deads.
Okay.
Now when they come back to doing rack deads, they're going to have an ability to pull from that lower position that they didn't have.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Train the nervous system. So now, instead of that failure point happening because of a neurological deficit at mm-hmm. the beginning, while they're trying to use accumulated reps to accumulate the stimulus to drive muscle growth by doing deadlifts, now instead of failing because they just can't get the bar moving from that bottom position, they're stronger in that range of motion. And they get two more reps. So they're getting 10 reps as opposed to 8 reps. And those reps aren't just like kind of reps tossed in because they just do an extra couple sets. And those are the effective reps.
Mm.
Those are the ones where they would do rep, and then they would just stall out on the bottom range of motion. No, they now get 2 more reps because they've been previously doing those full deads or deficit dead.
Right.
So those are the reps they wouldn't have gotten, the ones at the end of the set when they're really putting in maximal effort.
Okay.
Those are the ones that are going to drive adaptation and growth, assuming everything else is in place. So if you take an exercise, you know, that may feel kind of shitty in some way, shape, or form because the loading curve doesn't match, don't throw it out necessarily. Variety is going to help you because it's something different. And it may just be that the adaptations that come neurologically from that exercise, from being used to that, may carry over to some degree to other exercises for the same muscle group that are really similar in a way that lets you train harder with those other exercises.
Yeah.
So what was maybe an unknown sticking point to you, but where you tend to fail on that really well-constructed machine that feels really good, now that's not that sticking point anymore, and you're getting an extra rep for each set you take the failure.
I follow you. It. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no, like, perfect exercise. For anyone, really. But you can find some really good ones and you can find some really bad ones. And the idea is to figure out which ones are the really good ones for you that complement one another to some degree.
Yeah.
So like dips, for instance. Dips can be, there was a guy that I remember seeing post on a board, like what, it was like one of those questions, like what's your best chest exercise? And this guy just got really fucking good at like wide dips. And his chest was like, it looked like he just stuffed it full of Synthol or something, but it wasn't. You could tell that he hadn't done that.
Yeah.
It was just gigantic, but he did full, like all the way down, like, okay, you're going to fuck your shoulders up type of dips.
Yeah.
But then with control and he had good shoulder flexibility.
Hmm.
He always had, I think. Didn't have any shoulder issues, and he got really, really good at dips. And that for him was a great chest exercise. But let's say that dips are, those are mainly used as a tricep exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe triceps end up being just, they're so weak during your pressing exercises that even with a great mind-muscle connection, it would be nice to have a little more triceps available, because they just, no matter what you do, you can only get so good at that. Yeah. Well, now you get a little more triceps strength that comes. So you still can make the chest, you can carry out those sets a little bit further because you've done some other exercise to strengthen the accessory muscles.
Hmm.
So some exercises can complement one another. So that's kind of the point, the variety, but exercises that complement one another can make you better at other exercises, so you can get more out of those that work for you.
Okay.
So what else we got here? Another important thing is what rep range are you using?
Hmm.
So like this is what we said when we exchanged, like you sent me the video, I think about the same time you posted of you doing the pec deck.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned, as I had before, I think to you, that Marcus Rule used to do like really heavy cable flies.
Yeah. Yeah.
It, people are like, you know, your cable flies are just, they're a touch up exercise or they're a feel exercise or what have you.
Yeah.
But he would do them really, really heavy. And part of that is like, once you get so strong, you're flying all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Like I did those, it was about 2 weeks ago now, I was doing some loading sets, and that was my isolation exercise for chest. And I even had the daisy chains in place, and I was doing like a set of, I think I got 11 or 12, but it was hard as fuck to get into place.
I bet. Yeah.
It's so heavy, you know? And so I'm going to probably have to start weighing myself down again to do those and just feel like I'm not. Because I remember I pulled the thing over and I was on a pretty wide, and I'm like, oh shit. I was like flying back and forth before I finally got into place. Finally got him down. Once I was down, I was good to go, but it was very hard getting into place.
Yeah.
But so some exercises just will lend themselves better to higher reps. Some will lend themselves better to lower reps.
Hmm.
Some of those compounds might be just great thigh exercises for you or chest exercises, and you can train really heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are great exercises only if you go slow enough and controlled enough to target the muscle you're trying to train with a good mind-muscle connection.
Hmm.
So that's going to be a personal thing. So just because you can't go heavy on an exercise per se and feel it well doesn't mean you can't use that for a high rep exercise.
Hmm.
Like fortitude training, plug, a pump set. So you can pick exercises that might kind of suck, like a machine, let's say that's not the greatest machine for, it's a chest press, let's say, but just don't like the feel of it so much.
Mm-hmm.
But you can actually go lighter and find the part of the range of motion where you feel the chest and do partial reps and basically carry out a pump set, fortitude training style pump set.
Right.
And you can make a crappy machine work for you because you're not really trying to do progressive overload specifically with that. You're just trying to train really hard, and you're not going to target, you know, you're not going to say, I'm going to try to duplicate this what I did 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago and beat it every time.
Mm-hmm.
Progressive overload in my training system for pump sets is not, it's not where that aspect of training is focused. It's on the loading sets and the muscle rounds. So you can take a crappy exercise, and if it fits within your training regime,
mm-hmm.
and use that for a higher rep set, and just be sure that you have a really focused laser-like mind muscle connection. Force the target muscle to fail.
Mm, yeah.
Mission accomplished. You're not trying to like, you don't have to worry about the fact the machine kind of sucks in general, but you got some variety.
Mm.
So now you're doing a different exercise. And that variety in of itself is going to be an overload.
Yeah.
So you've undulated the rep range to a higher rep versus a lower rep, And you've also changed the exercise, which gives you variety, which I think is part of the novelty of creating a growth stimulus.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. So you got to find the exercise that matches the rep range as well that you're trying to use.
Yeah, that makes sense. I could see that because initially when we were talking about a machine with, say, drag or a machine with the strength curve that didn't match it, I could see, yeah, if you're working in that 6-7 rep range, then that might throw you off from actually being able to hit it. But if you're doing, say, a cluster set or something with higher reps, maybe it would be different for you.
Yeah. I mean, even like, let's say you have one that's got just terrible friction.
Okay.
But you're just going for a high rep set.
Yeah.
You could even like literally just do pulses on the way. I'm just thinking what I might do in that case, worst case scenario, just do pulses on the way up and come back down under control and just do pulses on the way up.
Yeah.
Just try to pulse it. Figure out what feels best. There's no rule, except that we sort of want to like have some sort of structure.
Yeah.
Just part of human nature, I think, to be structured. It says you have to do concentric, eccentric reps. Like you can do 1.5. People always do 1.5 reps.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an unknown thing. Partial reps. You can train however you want. There's so many ways you can do a quote unquote set.
Yeah.
All the different cluster sets that are available. Partials. You can do like I have the fives into the hole, which is the pump set that so many people do. I have one called triple thirds where you're doing like third part of the range of motion, 3 reps and then thirds. So a million ways you can do that. So you hop in the machine and feel out where you get the best mind-muscle connection. So you can make use of a crappy machine otherwise and utilize and train your mind-muscle connection and do the part of the rep where you feel it. If like literally changing direction just causes like a hiccup in the rep, then you wouldn't do those. You know, you do it some other way.
Yeah.
Maybe you just have to throw it all together. But most of the time you can find a way to make most machines, unless they're really bad, work. So, and this is a thought too. Bands, a lot of time, they seem, I think, because the tension is, if you've got, for instance, some sort of pivot point, like on a knee extension or something like that. And so that's being driven because you have a cable in place, let's say, and the tension creating the torque that you're resisting it when you do the reps comes from the stack that's behind you. So that's sort of pulling in one direction. If you put a band on and connect it to the frame or something like that, a lot of times that will stabilize that pivot point in a way that's noticeable. It'll take away from some play that you get, and it'll actually can reduce some of that friction sometimes.
Oh, I could see that.
It'll make the exercise feel better. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to just try that out. I've done that before. I'm like, man, there's something wrong with this, but if I throw a band on there and just, you know, lighten the load on the stack.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of exercises feel much better.
Hmm.
So especially ones where like you've got an ab machine, sometimes you'll see this, or like the knee extensions where you've got some wobbliness in it.
Mm-hmm.
The band will just prevent that wobbliness from being present when you're lifting, which sometimes it will, even if you got a heavy load on there, just so machines haven't been maintained well enough.
Yeah.
So the band's helping that regard too. So how do you know that the exercise is working? We talked about soreness. And then the obvious one is that you're getting a good pump.
Yeah.
Training. If you're not getting a good pump and you can't feel the pain in the muscle, then chances are you're not getting, either you maybe really depleted because you're, you know, you have no glycogen left.
Right.
And you're 4-3 weeks out or something like that. That's possible. But otherwise, something's probably not right. So that's when a pre-exhaust might help to make that connection. Some people would do kind of potentiation sets, just do a little bit, not even try to exhaust or pre-fatigue, just do an isolation exercise first, just sort of get themselves connected with the muscle they're trying to train with the compound.
Yeah.
And that works better. But if you're not getting those two things during and then after, so pump during, soreness after, at least when you first start the exercise, the soreness may subside, then you're probably not going to get the growth that you're looking for, at least not where you want it. So that is my spiel on picking an exercise.
All right. Can I ask you some questions? I've got some questions I wanted to ask you. All right. And we did have a few questions that came up too on the screen. One thing I wanted to ask you was about upright rows and if you personally had a preference on them. I've seen a bunch of people on YouTube, in various places. Somebody asked on one of our previous shows last week. It was on Blood, Sweat, and Gear with Dave Kalik, about hand placement. Now, and I have a couple of videos. I'm not going to edit those in now for the live feed, but I'll put them in for the YouTube. I used a wider grip and I used a narrower grip. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see the way it felt. And to me, I don't feel like the upright row is a great exercise for me personally. But when I went wider, I definitely felt like I was going to jack my shoulders up a little bit less. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to preface this because someone asked me to fit this in the podcast. I first have to say, I don't know shit about fuck. So that's in there now. That's a famous quote. Like that. Basically, now anything I say, I'm no longer held responsible
That's
for.
The disclaimer at the beginning of Muscle
That's
Minds.
That's my disclaimer.
I don't
know shit about fuck.
Yeah.
And also, it should be known, I'm the dude playing the dude pretending to be another dude. That's a very important line from the movie. I've just accomplished two check boxes. If she's watching, she had better be laughing her ass off right now.
Oh, it's a she.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know about that. We'll see. But so I don't like that exercise either.
Okay.
So much. But I actually came back around to it. I hadn't used it. Haven't used it in a while, too. I have a video on Instagram, I believe, doing that on a Smith machine.
Okay.
That where I felt a really nice connection. The problem is, I think this is what you were probably experiencing, is you feel like you're going to get some impingement going on.
Absolutely.
In your delt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how I typically feel. Sometimes if you're getting a nice angle and you get some really strange bending in your wrist,
mm-hmm.
kind of like this ulnar deviation that feels like it's pinching and it's not good for your wrist.
Yeah.
That can be a problem.
Yeah.
But some people love them.
Okay.
So that's one of those ones where it's funny because the shoulder is renowned for having the greatest range of motion really of any joint we've got. It's pretty phenomenal with the whole circumduction thing you can do. Like look at a swimmer or a tennis player, like the shoulder can have so many degrees of freedom,
yeah.
internal, external rotation and like full circumduction. So people will do like side laterals with all sorts of differing types of form. And because of the way in which their shoulder girdle sort of holds the shoulder joint in space,
mm-hmm.
how much, you know, what their typical postures, they spend their day on their phones or at the desk, how tight the chest is, all those sorts of things, that's going to dictate the angle of pull of the different muscles relative to gravity mm-hmm. about that joint. And so you can literally go here and here and externally, internally rotate, and the deltoid muscle is going to get a different headset. So the same thing I think applies to some degree to the upright row, except that whereas almost everyone can figure out some way to do like a side lateral, most people can without any pain unless their shoulders are really fucked up. I mean, mm-hmm. sometimes you've got really bad supraspinatus impingement and it's complete no-go. But you can find some way that works or some exercise. When you've then constrained yourself to doing an upright row, and the problem probably with most people is the internal rotation that comes with that.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. There's various ways you can do this, and I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, I'm not a physical therapist, but like one of the real basic ways to figure out if someone's got supraspinatus impingement is to have them try to do a horizontal or have it do internal rotation
mm-hmm.
and then shoulder flexion like mm-hmm. this. So lift up like that. And if that's painful, then if they've got all the other signs and symptoms, you're pretty certain you've got a supraspinatus impingement.
Okay.
So some people are just sort of prone to that. That's why you'll get it.
Okay.
They just don't have a very good gap. So the supraspinatus sits above the spine of the scapula. So that part, the bony part, you can sometimes see people that don't have a lot of muscle, you'll see it in the scapula. And so it's above the spine, it's the supraspinatus. It runs underneath the AC joint. And connects then to the humerus of the the upper arm bone, the humerus. So that little gap that it runs through, the little hole under there, under the acromial arch, is where it can get impinged.
Yeah.
And when you internally rotate, you're basically rotating the that bony attachment point upward, so that you can end up pressing that up against. And you may not have any irritation there, but you can feel, because you probably have had irritation there at some point in time. A lot of people have. I know you had bicipital impingement, which is a little bit different. Those are the two kinds of impingement in the shoulder, but it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah,
it's not the best. Like, you can imagine, like, where are you stronger, like this, or like this? Probably like this for most people. And you're going like that, you can be either causing some impingement that's, if it's already there, and it's sort of subclinical, you'll bring it out really quick. Like I've had situations where I've just done a set like that and I started to feel like I was getting impingement. I just pulled away from it.
Okay.
So side laterals, you can figure out a way, you know, some angle, some amount of internal external rotation, you can bend forward, what have you. Whereas upright rows, you're kind of limiting your options. Your degrees of freedom that the shoulder is normally capable of are limited, because you're trying to stick with this plane of motion, driving up with the elbows, with the internal rotation, which for some people feels great. It makes it just an elbow exercise, or sorry, a delt exercise, minimal elbow movement, so minimal arm involvement. But for other people, that's just not going to work for their shoulders, just because of the architecture, potential for supraspinatus impingement, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So you're just going to have like a section of people just can't do it. No matter what, how they try it.
So. Yeah. That's kind of, that was kind of the consensus I've heard on some of the other shows too.
But I tell you, here's the thing. Yeah. I did it on the Smith machine, and I think it was helpful for me, because I could grip more loosely the machines in the track, and I could just drive up with the elbows, and I got that to work, actually.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't do it like every week, but I actually got it to work in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do with a barbell, I don't think. I think I tried it, but I was able to do those for, you know, 6 months or so on a regular basis. So
okay,
that could be a fix if someone's looking for another delt exercise.
All right. This one kind of even applies to a lot of the stuff we were talking about today about getting activation. This is from Rebecca Libby, and she asks, rack pulls right below the knee, how to recruit more lat and less traps.
Okay. Well, traps are going to be, they're going to be recruited to some degree, because you just got to hold the weight. Like, they're there to make sure that your shoulder girdles don't, you know, come off your body. But the way to get, for most people, to get the, there's a couple things you can do. One, do a pre-fatigue or a potentiation or an activation set with some lat pull downs. So pre-fatigue them. Arching your back and keeping the bar close to your body will tend to do that as well. And if you want to learn how to do that, here's a very, very brutal way of doing that. And you got to be kind of strict, but these are just like obnoxiously rough. Get a metronome and set it for, you know, 60 beats per minute, 1 second beats.
Okay.
And pull up rapidly, arching everything, and then keep that arch, and then do a 4 second descent. So four centric, eccentric. So you pull up, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up, 0, 1, 2, 3, and try to do a set of like 15 to 20 like that.
Wow. Okay.
You use like 50 to 60% of like the weight you normally would do for like sets of 10, maybe. You go pretty light.
Yeah.
And the whole time, just focus on contracting your lats.
Huh.
Those are brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what kind of helped me was doing like an isometric contraction against the bar before lifting the weight. So like flexing the lats against the bar, and then beginning to, you know, turn that isometric into a concentric pull while I'm flexing those lats and contracting them in order to, you know, keep it there. That seemed to help me.
Rebecca's a competitor. I didn't see her. She's a competitor.
Yeah.
She did nationals last year, I think.
Okay.
So you can think about like when you're pulling back.
Yes. Yeah.
To show the Christmas tree. Like literally you're going to do that. Scapula's back. Everything's arched.
Yeah.
Some people say that you get, people want to say like round your back during a, like lat pull downs and various things. Like there's, that's a theme that some people suggested works better for isolating the lats. I've never found that at all. I never had that sense, but some people have tried that on deadlifts like this. I wouldn't try that or do exactly what you were saying, Scott, is, you know, pull everything back hard.
One other thing like that is to reference the earlier part of our show too, is maybe the amount of weight, because like you had said, right, that if you have that max load, the closer it is to max load, you're not going to be able to, you know, differentiate between the muscle groups. Right.
And that's why I suggested this lighter load, like tempo thing, because,
oh, I see.
You
I
learn.
See.
Oh, I think the first time I did those, yeah, I remember I did it with a guy back in Tucson.
Yeah.
And we both had the same problems. Like I couldn't wipe my butt every time I wiped, my lats were cramping.
Yeah.
It was that bad. I hadn't wrecked my lats like that, I don't think, ever. It was the worst. And it was, and those were rack deads.
Nice.
But it was a total lat exercise.
Nice.
And the other thing, and I think Rebecca's probably seen this, there's also row stop deads.
I think we do these in Ohio?
Yes, we did.
Oh, those are brutal.
That kind of came up. Yeah. Yep. So check those out. I won't go through trying to explain those. Those, but I've got those on my Instagram.
Okay.
Maybe you can pull that up. Okay. Throw it in there.
I'll look for that. Brandon asks, let's see here, arm growth for a wheelchair user. Do I overtrain my arms to try to force growth due to using them all the time? It's a good question.
Yeah. I'm going to click on his profile and see. Yeah, it looks like he's so Brandon. I wonder if he's got probably has a spinal cord injury. Let's see. I see he's wakeboarding there.
Yeah, I see that in his profile picture.
Yeah.
Definitely not stopping him from doing what he wants to do.
Yeah. Oh, hell no. No. I mean, I don't, he knows. Scott, we've talked about, I spent a couple years doing research with people with spinal cord injuries.
Yeah.
I worked at a specialty hospital in it's called the Shepherd Center in downtown. Here he is. I think he's competing. Oh, cool. Yeah, there he is. Okay, so yeah, that's a conundrum, because you're going to get potentially an interference effect. Mm. So you're rolling around all this time, you know, like literally he's sort of using his arms. Oh, there he is with Derek Lunsford. Okay, I think. Yeah, cool. Well, if you're down here and you run into Derek, let me know, because Derek lives down here in Tampa. We can go train. But so yeah, that's the thing. I have to know what's been working. So has he tried heavier training? The thing you run into with arms is you end up getting tendonitis.
Yeah, yeah.
And that can be exacerbated. So you're walking a very fine line. So in an ideal world, because he wants to be able to roll around, he wouldn't be using, he'd be able to, you know, not have to do those things. You, instead of like, it's like, this is the conundrum that construction workers run into.
Yeah.
They're doing heavy manual labor all the time.
Yeah.
And they're trying to go lift, and the manual labor makes it harder to lift. And they got this constant overload that's happening during the day where they're hammering stuff and working a jackhammer and picking heavy loads up.
Right.
And that's interfering with their recovery. So I would probably, if I were him and he's not sure what's worked,
mm-hmm,
I would probably try try like an 8-week period or a training blast, 2 or 3 months,
mm-hmm,
and go just doing things with somewhat heavier.
Okay.
In comparison with what he's doing, like during the day, he's rolling around a lot.
Yeah.
And then see what that does. And then literally, like, so maybe we're talking like 8 to 10 rep range.
Okay.
Something where, as long as he's not getting any tendonitis, like if it starts to bug your triceps tendons, then stop, because then you'll just run into, like, then you can't do any pressing. You'll run into issues with shoulders,
yeah,
and chest and tricep, and see what happens there. And then go to a higher rep range and try doing like sets at 25 to 30.
After 8 weeks. There. Yeah,
after like long enough to give it, you know, when he's eating properly and trying to gain weight, so he can give it a fair test. He's got he's got an anabolic environment otherwise.
Yeah,
and so he's kind of doing a. I mean, if he really wants to, like, he could do this. He could do what we talked about with that Domus study, and he could try. There's all sorts. He could literally try one arm heavy and the other arm light.
Don't do that. We don't need to find out that bad. We don't need to find out. Well, I guess he could do the opposite. He could do the opposite for the next 8 weeks.
He could do a crossover.
Yeah.
You know, it could be a function of frequency. So so he's going to have to be sort of somewhat sort of scientific.
Yeah.
And experimental in this to try to figure out what works for him. The other option, which he may not have tried, which could be interesting, is a blood flow restriction type of thing. I'm not huge on that.
Yeah.
You know. But that's what you're going to get from the higher rep stuff. But that would be something that, you know, that's where they get the greatest rate of muscle growth.
Yeah.
That I've seen.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Carry that out for a while. So, and you can run into tendonitis issues there. So that's for him. I'm always concerned about the clot happening. Normally it would be a problem with the lower body more so than the upper.
Okay.
So, but he may have, like, because he's in a chair, I believe there's increased risk for clotting too, because he's not getting, if he's on antispasticity meds, he's not getting hardly any contractions down there. So the blood just pools to some degree.
He could he could ask Mario Novo. Dr. Mario Novo would be a good guy to approach about that. I mean, that's his jam right there. We did a podcast with him about blood flow restriction. If you haven't heard that one, you could check that out and then definitely reach out to him, see his thoughts. Yeah.
Here's a way that he could also try to, so there are different options depending. It's hard to know because we don't know what he's been doing, but
yeah.
I to some degree, I'm waiting for someone to present this data on the high rep training because for some reason they just don't, but form's going to follow function.
Okay.
To some degree. So if he's really strong on these arm movements already.
Yeah.
And maybe I would imagine that he doesn't have horrible muscle endurance, otherwise he wouldn't be able to get around very well. Then in that case, try to get better at the high rep movements.
Hmm.
But if he's doing lots of this endurance stuff, he's got no problem with that, but he's relatively weak, then go try to get really strong.
Yeah.
So if he goes from, you know, sets of 20 with 100 pounds to 150 pounds, that's going to show up in muscle size.
Yeah.
That's a high rep. Do that if he's not already good at those things. If he's if he goes from sets of 10 with 200 pounds to sets of 10 with 250 pounds, that's going to show up too. So try to pick one or the other, I would, depending on where he's already good at. So if he's already plenty strong, go with the high rep. If he tends to think he's not so great on the endurance end, try that and see what it's about. So.
All right. Matt asks, is there an optimal way to combine cardio and strength training? He says, I have a limited time. I have a limited time. Should I do one before the other?
Ideally, you separate them. So you're not going to interfere with the cardiovascular gains for the most part, but you want to separate them by maybe 6 to 8 hours.
Okay.
If at all possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the form that's least likely to cause, at least like in leg size, some interference is probably cycling.
Yeah.
So running's not going to be your best bet. The question there is why you would be doing both of those. So if you're trying to expend energy, my thought would be increase your NEAT. Don't do the cardio if you're thinking like strictly trying to optimize bodybuilding results. If you just like the cardio and the running, then separate them and try to do them on different days if you can. I'm trying to think how this is, there's disadvantages. Like if you go, I think if you do cardio first and then the weight training, I think it's some animal research suggests you're going to increase muscle breakdown. If you do, weight training first, and then you do the cardio. Mm-hmm. From a couple studies, you're gonna dampen the protein synthetic effect of the training. So either way, there's an interference effect that happens, and you're turning on literally different pathways of adaptation with cardio versus strength training. So, But the best, and this, there's some research studies that have shown this, is to keep those things separate. Definitely wouldn't want to do cardio before training legs.
Yeah.
And I would try to give yourself a like before the same session. Some people can get away with that shit and they're just fine. Those who are doing higher volume types of stuff, it's probably okay. If your progress is based on a heavier loading, progressive overload type of thing, DC training, fortitude training, Jordan's type of training, Dorian's type of training, that kind of thing, then you're probably not going to do yourself any favors by doing the cardio first.
Hmm.
You're going to want to save that for like a day later,
okay,
maybe even two, so you've got some recovery time in there, or the day before, so you can recover from that previous session. So I always try to separate the leg, keep the leg day as isolated both before and after as possible. And that depends on, you know, what days of the week you can train, what your split is, and those sorts of things. So upper body, you're not so worried about, especially if you're cycling.
Now, if he's just looking to do cardio, just to be, he wants to try to burn some fat and he's walking on a treadmill, then I'm going to just simplify it with my opinion and throw that in there and say, just do it after you train. If you're going to combine it, then my suggestion would be to do your training with weights and then do your whatever it is, 25 minutes of cardio, walking on the treadmill after that. If I were to combine them, because that's what the options were, that was my option. I don't have enough time. He's busy or whatever. Then that's, I mean, if that's was going to be the thing, because he might not be able to come back and do it another time. He might be working 12 hours and have a family and maybe, you know, if he feels he needs to do cardio. I know you're not a big cardio guy at all. You're not a fan of the cardio.
Not for strict bodybuilding purposes.
Yeah.
No, it's like it's going to limit your overall potential there. But if it's after upper body training, then yeah. I mean, here's the thing too. You can take in like a post-workout shake and still do your cardio.
Yeah.
I mean, people will say, oh, you're not going to burn any fat. Like, that's true. You're going to burn the energy that's presented, but it doesn't mean that you don't expend calories.
Yeah.
You still will expend the same calories. So, and if it's just walking, you can walk whenever.
Yeah.
So you could, you know, walk home from the gym maybe or something like that.
Yeah. That would save time too. There you go.
Oh, hell yeah. So it kind of, there's like so much that's so generic. You know, it's hard to know.
Okay.
Cause why he's doing it all, but yeah. So there's lots of information there he can probably sift through.
Kyle asks, can an untrained female that recently nailed down her diet, use Clen 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, rinse and repeat? I didn't know we were going to have a Clen question today.
I'm not seeing let me see. This is on the Advices Radio.
Just can an untrained female that recently nailed down her diet use Clen? I suppose yes. I mean, could you?
I mean, she could snort coke and she could drink cyanide water. I mean, she could do whatever she wants. I'm not sure why he's asking. I'm not trying to be like sarcastic, but why?
Well, I'm going to say that.
The diet, can she use Clen or does she need to use Clen? Can you tell? I can't see the question, so I'm not
sure
why.
That's it. I just read it word for word. That's all you got.
Okay. Yeah. I don't see if she's nailed the diet down, she doesn't need to use Clen. So, I mean, she could, but.
Well, how about this? Let me play devil's advocate here. How about you can speed the process up? Once you say you nailed the diet down and you're making fat loss progress, then wouldn't using a fat burner accelerate that process? Where, you know, in our society, we want fast. You know, we want the answers. We want the results now. And I imagine that's the vast majority of people who are going to use a fat burner are doing it so that they can accelerate that process.
Yeah. Did it say that? There's 10 comments and I can only see 4 of them somewhere. Have you blocked me, Scott?
You're blocked.
What's going on here?
It's
fucking weird.
I wanted to keep
I only
you.
See 4 of them.
Maybe they're coming in from, I have all the comments from everywhere. So maybe that's what it is.
Ah, okay. Did he say something that she's dieting down for a show still?
No.
There was something at the beginning.
An untrained female that recently nailed down her diet use Clen 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off?
Yeah, she can. But she nailed her diet down?
You melted Scott's mind on this one.
Yeah, of course she. But why would she if she's got the diet down to burn fat faster?
Yeah.
But she's not even training. I would suggest my thought is that yes, she could.
Yeah.
Here's the let me play the devil's advocate to the devil's advocate here.
Okay.
I'm going to play the archangel Gabriel here, or whatever that would be. Is if she's not even training, and she's got her diet down, and you then to take it the one step forward, introduce Klen, what does that set her up for in the future?
Okay.
As far as like being able to institute lifestyle changes, like what's going to behoove her? You've already done a phenomenal thing in getting her diet nailed down. That's friggin' awesome. Like that's ginormous if that's really the case.
Yeah.
And like the next thing along those lines would be to start exercising, which is something that she can sustain, that she can do for, you know, the rest of her life, ideally. Yeah. Whereas Klen is probably not something you want to be on for sustained periods of time.
Yeah.
It's going to have, you know, potential effects on heart remodeling, that kind of stuff. So it sounds like she's making good progress. She doesn't have we don't know about a show. We have nothing else. That just seems like an out of place next step for someone who's just not training and has got the diet down.
I would agree with you on that.
Yeah. Well, like you played the devil's advocate. That was great. That was awesome.
Yeah, I would say exercise, you know, and if she doesn't want to exercise, I mean, can she do it? Yeah, you can do it. She could use DNP. She could get liposuction. You know, she could do any of these things, you know?
Right.
But yeah. Would it be, you know, I mean, risk to reward? I mean, like you said, setting someone up. I mean, realistically, she could use the cleanse. She could lose some fat. And I mean, I don't know.
I tell you what, though, this is really interesting here. So this, I think we can make use of this question in a way that maybe he didn't intend, because, and I don't know who asked it. What was the name of the
person? I'm done with it. It's gone. I can't see it anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the things that's interesting is that he's asking, like, kind of asking for permission.
Yeah.
Sounds like in a way, and that's the thing is like. Sometimes if he's asking for permission to use a drug, that I think that's an out of place to be. Mm. When it comes to pharmaceutical use, for someone else, especially, because my thought is that the drugs would only be used when you have a really keen understanding of what they're doing and why you would use them in very specific ways.
Yeah.
So, and you've got all the other eyes, not just the diet, but the exercise and all the other things in place. And you've got a very specific goal.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the flip-flop that's happened with social media. You know, I hate to just keep on bringing his name up. I think he's gotten much better than like the Boston Lloyds who would just say drugs are the answer type of thing. There's a mindset, and it's a human mentality to look for a magic bullet, so to speak, to make things easier. So in my mind, the more important thing is to prioritize and when and for what reasons you would be using those different tools for fat loss.
Yeah.
And along the judgment of or the series of ways in which you'd add those in, Klen would be at the very end for someone who's trying to only going to use it temporarily to try to drop weight for a contest, et cetera, et cetera. You want to have exercise and all those other things in line far before that. And you want to know, like, the question is, like, can she do it? Well, yes, she could, but that kind of suggests to me that he may not even know what it does, what its actions are, like, what are the side effects, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
How would he know if he starts, if he's not sure, he's asking it in that way. And I'm not trying to pick on whoever this was, but it's just sort of general for someone. If you're asking, you know, can you use this? That's the type of question that you might ask, like your doctor, literally when you're under a doctor's supervision, and say, yeah, okay, that would be an option. And the doctor's going to say, you know, come back and see me in a week, you know, take this aspirin, call me in the morning type of thing. And you're under medical supervision to look at side effects. You could do an EKG if it's affecting your heart, all those sorts of things. So if you're asking that question, but you're not under doctor's supervision, you don't really know how the drug works or when and how to use it, then you wouldn't know what some signs would be to stop using it, or how to use it or when not to use it. So that's kind of a dangerous place to be. where you don't, if you're not even sure if you, if you're asking if you can use it.
Yeah.
The question is whether you should use it. And the other question is when you should stop using it.
Yeah.
So the questions are sort of flip flop.
All right.
The way I'm thinking about it.
Matt O'Neill asks, will this be archived somewhere? Yes. So we record these live on Facebook, and then the recorded versions are all released over at Advices Radio. You can go to advicesradio.com. That'll be the audio also available on basically every podcast app. We can also, we also have the video version that will be at YouTube. You can go to Think Big Bodybuilding Media, where this and several other podcasts are released each week with people like the wonderful mind-melting Dr. Scott.
I got my mind melted today.
You did. You did.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know shit about Fox, guys. Don't.
All right, man. I appreciate your time as always. And once again, I had a lot of fun on that, that last podcast, 'cause I've been really into this whole heavy duty thing. And it's taken me 4 years of podcasting with you that I finally, your ideas have been making sense to me. And I'm converted now to heavy duty style, high intensity, higher frequency, lower volume training. And it's finally, finally working for me.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, don't go too far. I don't want you to, like, you know,
one set.
I train chest tomorrow and then I'm going to train it again on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Because
one set,
full recovery. Yeah.
4 months. Every 4 months I train chest once, and it's only like a couple reps.
Just one rep, one all out exercise only. That's it.
And I just bail, just drop the dumbbells.
Yeah, and then I'm done.
Yeah.
Fall on the floor, gasp.
Yeah.
And then rest until the next holiday.
Yeah. But for real, Matt, if you enjoy this, check us out over at Think Big Bodybuilding Media on YouTube. Everybody here, if you want to head over and do us a favor, you can subscribe, like the videos, comment, all that, because all that stuff helps to boost us in the algorithm. If you've enjoyed Dr. Scott, if Scott's melted your mind today, he could melt your mind a lot more with his book. It's called Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. We will have links in the description at the YouTube and on the Advices Radio. You can go to so BYOBB.
Mind melting technique. Just
yes.
Put it right there.
BYOBBcoach.com. And we've got the Amazon link for the hardcover.
This is the thumbnail right here for the podcast, by the way.
Yes.
I think.
You can go to TrueNutrition.com. You can get great supplements like this, fish oil, and I also have their whole food multivitamin. Use our code ADVICES on supplements that are fantastic and that you would have bought them anyway. And, of course, check out GetAzoff.com and check out some powerful, powerful nootropics, as Joe Rogan would say. Powerful. Dr. Scott, it's been a pleasure as always, man.
Likewise, my friend.